there are those that project into a utopian future where AI really plays the role of humans in roles that humans don't like to play. There's those that also see that exact same future and get extremely pessimistic and worried about it.
All that and more on Mixture of Experts. All right. Hello, everyone. I am Brian Casey. It is back to school week this week, and Tim's kid gave him a fever immediately. So you are all stuck with me. And I think that's a situation we can all, as parents, at least for those of you that are, understand and get ready for in terms of the fall season. So you're all stuck with me today. Welcome to Mixture of Experts. Every week we bring together a panel of experts, technologists, product leaders to talk about the latest news in AI. And today I'm joined by a great crew. We have Kautar Almograwi, who is the principal research scientist and manager for the Hybrid Cloud Platform. We have Gabe Goodhart, chief architect for AI Open Innovation, and Mihai Crivetti, who is this distinguished engineer for Agentic AI. As always, we have a packed episode this week. We'll be talking about Anthropic's recent raise. We'll be talking about skepticism, AI bears, and an AI winter. But we're going to start off with the biggest story of the week, which was we finally got some clarity on where Google's antitrust case was going to land. Before we get into that, though, I'm going to turn things over to Aili Makonnen, who's going to take us through just a couple of the other top stories of the week. So, Aili, over to you.
Hey, everyone. I'm Aili Makonnen. I'm a tech news writer with IBM Think. Before we dive into today's main episode, I'm here with a few AI headlines you may have missed this busy week. First up, OpenAI has added new safeguards to ChatGPT so it can better detect emotional distress in teens and other users in crisis and guide them to the real-world support they need. And our next news item, IBM and the semiconductor company AMD are teaming up. They're combining the power of quantum computing with traditional computing and AI to create quantum-centric supercomputing. Meanwhile, your back-to-school shopping may look a little bit different. Amazon has just launched Amazon Lens Live, so next time you're out shopping, you can hold your phone, point it at an object, and see some matching products that you can swipe through. And last but not least, you may never need to worry again that Starbucks is going to run out of your favorite vanilla cold cream or caramel drizzle. Why? Starbucks baristas will soon only need a tablet to scan store and supply shelves, and the built-in AI tools will identify which items are running low and then automatically reorder them. Want to dive deeper into some or all of these topics? Subscribe to the IBM Think newsletter, linked in the show notes. And now back to our episode.
So we'll kick things off today by talking about the Google antitrust case. For those of you who have been following this closely, a lot of people have considered it the biggest case, antitrust case in tech since the 98 case in US versus Microsoft. So some have even called it like a blockbuster case. And for those of you who have been following it or may not have been following it, this case actually kicked off, and it's obviously about Google's search business, but it kicked off in 2002. The year 2020, so 5 years ago, which feels like an eternity. And I think one of the most interesting aspects of the case is just how much has changed over the last 5 years in this particular space. Obviously, with the reason this show exists is because of how much has happened in AI. And it turns out that that actually played a significant role in just the ruling that was ultimately came down, which was, I think, a more conservative was the way that it was described in the market approach to the ruling than I think more dramatic results could have been. And so what actually ended up happening, there was a lot of discussion about whether Google was going to be forced to divest things like Chrome or Android, whether they would still be able to pay to be the default in things like browsers and devices. The ruling ended up coming down was that Google is going to keep Chrome and Android as part of this. They will continue to be able to pay to be part of, be the default search engine for platforms like browsers and devices. But there's a few things that did come down as well as part of that, which is, so one, some of the exclusivity agreements that Google has today, they can't pursue that in the way that they used to. And there's also limited data sharing with some of their potential competitors in the space. The intention there, I think, is to just make it easier for other entrants and, you know, more dynamic marketplace, essentially. But to go back to the point about this case originated in 2020, and it's now 2025, and one of the big reasons why it was a more conservative ruling was because of everything that's happened in AI. I'm just going to read a couple lines from the document here, where one, generative AI technologies pose a quote-unquote a threat to the primacy of traditional internet search. The money flowing into the space and how quickly it has arrived is astonishing. These companies are already in a better position, both financially and technologically, to compete with Google than any traditional search company has been in decades, potentially. So the whole category sort of changed over the last 5 years. And that's really what I want to talk about, is just kind of where we are in this space between the search market, the AI market, the way that they're converging. And so let's just start with maybe defaults and the extent to which you all believe they're still and how important they are in this space. Because if I were to make maybe just a counterpoint on this, and Gabe, maybe I'll start with you on this one. ChatGPT, as far as I know, has hundreds of millions of users and is one of the fastest growing, if not the fastest growing products of all time. If defaults were really that big of a deal, how is it growing this quickly? And are these defaults as important and powerful as people say they are? Or, you know, is all this happening anyways?
Yeah. Okay. Let's start with the question about defaults. How many different applications did you use today before logging into this this session? Probably a couple hundred. How many individual settings do you think each of those applications has buried in its configuration profile? Probably tens of thousands in total. Defaults in software engineering are one of the great unsung heroes of us actually being able to use software in our daily lives. And so something as big as your default entry point into the internet is a big deal, even if for those of us that are enthusiasts, you're likely going to change one piece of that default, maybe even the primary piece of that default. For the vast majority of humans out there who do not join AI podcasts, if it works, it works. Don't mess with it, right? And if the button is there when I grab my phone off the shelf, I'm going to click that button until that button stops working for me. So I think defaults are extremely important in this case. I think, this ruling is clearly a win for Google in some ways because they can still throw their financial muscle around and remain in that default position. I do think one of the things that the article we all prepped with didn't call out was that there is a pretty big win here for the enthusiast consumer who's willing to change a default. And that, I think, becomes around the fact that there's been a pretty clear line between generative AI and search for the most part. I think the place where that blurs the most is when you start getting the AI-generated results from Google. But technologically, they're not actually that different. In fact, one of the very best uses of generative AI is good search. And I think up until now, to your point, Brian, ChatGPT has, I don't know how many millions of users at this point. And it probably, if people have organization on their phones, lives in a different bucket than the Google icon, right? Like it literally lives in one labeled AI or something like that. For it to truly make its way into that default position where it takes over the crown of the thing that people click on the most on their phones, it's got to start blurring and being that just utility that people go to when they want to get something done, like learn some knowledge, find something on the internet. So I do think this will start to allow that sort of user experience blurring to happen in a way that it hasn't up until now because of these exclusivity agreements. So being allowed to frame an AI tool as a search option on a mobile device, I think can potentially change the landscape from being a one horse race to a many horse race, which could be interesting.
I do think the idea that there could be that these AI tools are challenging for that role as the default. It hasn't happened yet, though. Like I've seen a lot of is that on platforms like Twitter, everybody says, oh, I don't use Google anymore. I only use these AI tools. And Twitter is obviously a pretty unique sort of echo chamber. And so perhaps not broadly reflective of the entire consumer market on planet Earth at this point. But what I don't see as much of is chatter about the browsers, devices, them flipping over from like Google and search as like the primary sort of interface into the web and making that instead these AI tools. And I'm curious, like, what you think the barrier is there? Like, what has to happen for, you know, companies like, you know, Mozilla or Apple or whoever else to look at that and say, like, okay, we actually want to have kind of more AI generated be kind of more the default versus the traditional web? Because I haven't totally seen the appetite for that yet. And I'm curious whether you think that's a consumer behavior, you know, sort of obstacle for them to overcome, if it's a technological limitations, maybe a little of both. But, you know, they're not coming to the defaults yet. And I'm curious what you think the barriers are there.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And there is a twist here, I think, especially with AI. So, of course, you know, I totally agree with Gabe that defaults are so important, you know, for decades of research, you know, show us that most users stick with defaults. So they don't switch settings. And this is why Google was willing to pay, you know, Apple like more than 20 billion annually to secure, you know, Safari's defaults. So there is, you know, really strength there. And with AI, there's a switch, especially the way that the search is evolving right now with these AI assistants. So the importance of defaults, I believe, intensifies because the assistant is not just routing you to link, it's shaping also the answer. And especially now with agentic, you know, there will be routing to so many different tools and their need that you're not even aware of. And that maybe defaults there will also be, you know, very important. So I think platform partnerships are important here. You know, I think Apple here or maybe other platform makers, they're becoming kingmakers here. So if Siri defaults you to OpenAI or Anthropic instead of Google, the balance of power in AI search here shifts overnight. So I think here it's really important to really understand how these partnerships are shaping because for the users, you know, they initially they're going to be presented with products, you know, which one is better. It's like that initial experience sometimes is sticky. So the platforms that present these things and underneath the hood, especially with agents right now, where are they going to go? Where are they going to default? That's going to be really important. So how do we break that? How do we get into that partnerships? That's, I think, going to be very important for also, you know, all of these new, you know, startups or companies that want to get into the space. And maybe there, the monopoly is still, you know, having a big role here. So who's going to maybe pay the most in these big AI partnerships? Who still has, you know, that power? So I think the ruling that happens, it's kind of, I feel it's a mixed bag here. So it is definitely a short win for Google because it avoids the breakup and it protects its core business model. But I think for competitors, including the AI startups and the AI makers, the ruling is a mixed bag. So on the one hand, the judge did not break up Google, which many rivals, you know, were hoping for. But on the other hand, you know, the data sharing mandate is, I think it's seen as a lifeline here. So AI companies like OpenAI, Perplexity and so forth, they stand to benefit the most because they can now access also this trove of information to improve their own answer engines and also try to compete more directly with Google. But I feel having, you know, also a way to penetrate that partnership with the platform makers like Apple is going to also be key.
Yeah, I'm thinking here that really Google wins because they get to keep Chrome. Apple wins because they get to keep the $20 billion from Google and now open up for additional revenue from OpenAI, from Anthropic, from all these other businesses and AI new search engines. I guess some of the folks that are not going to win from this moment is, you know, folks like Mozilla and Firefox and some of the smaller browsers. And, you know, they still get revenue from even Google because they get paid as well to make Google the default search engine on their platforms or Bing or some other search engine. But they're not really, they don't really have an avenue to penetrate this market. And I think that's something to look at as well. We're consolidating all of the search and all of the AI capabilities in the hands of maybe three or four large organizations. You've got your Google, your OpenAI, your Anthropic, the frontier models, maybe Perplexity. They're going to have a way to provide that level of funding necessary to get, if not in the default, at least in the second or third option when you use the search, but some of the smaller providers are not going to have a mechanism to get in there. And the second thing I'm thinking about here is, what kind of things are you really searching for when you're using your phone versus when you're using your tablet or when you're using your computer? Because usually when I'm using my phone, I'm out of the house, right? I'm searching for, you know, nearby restaurant that is open. So there's still going to be a necessity for the traditional search engine. They do all the legwork. They still have all the data. They have data from maps. They have data from businesses, from reviews. Even if you apply AI on top, it's still going to be Google's data or Bing's search data. And I don't really see OpenAI or some of the other AI providers have that current data availability. They can build agents, they can build on top of that data. And I think for what you get on your phone, it's not as much relevant for what you would use on your desktop or on other applications, because nobody's going on their phone and saying, how do I create a Python program to do this? And you get the AI answer, it's going to be better than the first three hits on Stack Overflow, and you're going to pick that answer. So I think watch this space is going to take a couple more years before we see a major impact from these top search engines. And the search engines themselves are now prioritizing the AI answer. So when you use Google Search or Bing, you're getting the AI summary to kind of compete back with these kind of AI vendors as well.
Oh, just one more thing to a question that you threw out earlier that really struck me is the question of why we aren't seeing these AI apps replace or start to encroach on basic browser apps. Yeah. You did ask the question of whether there's a technology element to that, and I do think there is. And I think it's around the visual portion of the user experience. The web is a very visual place, right? You go to a given web page, if it were just a pile of text, you would probably immediately turn your brain off. Almost every website out there has a banner, has something that is visually appealing to draw you in. And right now, the UX of AI assistance is primarily text-based. There's novelty to that text because it's text framed directly to you. And that in and of itself, you know, has brought about the AI revolution we're in today. But I think part of the reason we haven't seen these things come closer together is that UX layer. There's nothing fundamental about the technology of generative AI that prevents that. It's just a level of generated output that we haven't really seen incorporated into the UX for these AI platforms. So I think, to the point I was trying to make that I don't know if I articulated well, I think this ruling actually sets the grounds for those technologies to start coming together. And I think those exclusivity agreements have probably been a big barrier to actually trying to blur the lines between what you get if you're just looking for a purely informational answer. AI is probably the best way to get that right now versus an experiential result of something that's got visual elements to it, something that's got interactive elements to it beyond just text and multi-turn chat. So I'm really curious to see now where this goes from a UX perspective.
One of the things that I always think about with the browser in particular, like people look at that as this like critical point of distribution for like very obvious reasons, right? But the thing the browser is like a portal to the internet. And so like an AI is only kind of that, right? Whereas search is explicitly that right now. And one of the things that I kind of go back and forth on is like, is the browser even the right way to think about how like the main kind of distribution model for these things going forward? Because even when I was prepping for this podcast, I'm a heavy user of both traditional search and AI tools. And I have like slightly different ways I use both of them. And I move back and forth between them all the time. And to me, I'm actually like, to me, they feel like portals into two different worlds where one, I want to go interact with the web and the other one, I want to talk to an assistant. And those are closer, like to me, they feel a little bit less like two areas that could converge into one thing versus two distinct portals that have some sort of overlapping Venn diagram. And I'm curious whether y'all see that as the case. Like, do you ultimately imagine kind of like the web and AI and browsers converging into like one giant blob of a thing? And maybe the UX will feel better than a giant blob, hopefully at that point. Or do you imagine these things kind of living in parallel with like obvious points of intersection, but kind of two fundamentally different things at the end of the day?
Maybe I can jump in here. I think the user experience is already experiencing a lot of changes right now with all of these AI native assistants and chatbots and agents. So I expect that at some point things will converge, but that's my point of view. And especially that, you know, I think maybe we'll see new user interfaces that are not like browser-based where you scroll down and pick and, you know, move from one page to another. Maybe there'll be neuromorphic, you know, interfaces, you know, brain interfaces, voice assistants. So things that are surrounding us. So I think we're in the time where we see the biggest kind of, revolution in these user interfaces that we haven't seen in decades. I think the biggest changes were maybe with the Apple iPhone, before that was the graphical interfaces. But now I think we're in for another big change in the user experience, especially with these chatbots. So at that time, it's not going to be switching back and forth. Probably it's going to be like a more converged experience. And the user interfaces we see today will be, you know, back interfaces or maybe, you know, back-end systems. And the front-end systems will be completely new ways of interacting with the users. And the back-ends will kind of route, you know, to maybe a more traditional APIs or agentic or AI. So it's going to be, I think, a mix. And I'm hoping to see the conversion in that world. You know, what does it mean, you know, to all of these competitors? What search will look like? And so I think it's going to evolve into this more, hopefully will converge into different interfaces that, you know, all are, you know, having a mix of different user interactions, whether it's voice or touching or brain-based interfaces.
Yeah, I think Mark Zuckerberg is now thinking metaverse. Marina?
Yes.
It's finally time.
Finally.
Yeah. So I have one, you know, thought on this. And Mihai, I was curious if you were going to jump in on this as well. But I actually think, to your point, Brian, right now, our mental model of them being two separate channels is a technological, like, we're just not quite there yet. And to me, it's around the interface. So this is why I was curious if Mihai, our MCP expert, was going to jump on this. But right now, I actually had an interesting conversation with a colleague recently who is deeply in this space. I was explaining that models don't call tools. And that was shocking at the moment, that in fact, a model has absolutely no ability to do anything. All it can do is produce a token. That's it. That's all it can do. A system wrapped around a model can do a whole lot more, including invoke arbitrary code, grab things off the internet, frame things as tools that the model can then generate tokens to say, hey, that seems like the right step that I should take. Please go do this system that is wrapped around me. And to that end, we are still in this, I would say, kind of infancy of expanding beyond a textual user experience for the actual set of tokens that go into the model and the set of tokens that come out of the model. And, you know, we keep throwing around the word agentics, but really, I think what that fundamentally means is the evolution of the models in conjunction with the expanded, essentially, conventions that we're coming up with for input tokens and output tokens. And in particular, right now, we have no convention whatsoever for output tokens that imply visual user interactive experiences, or to your point, Kotar, not even necessarily visual, but non-textual user experiences, right? You can throw an arbitrary tool, and if that tool happens to know how to render as a dial in some dashboard, cool. But the models themselves have no sort of inherent knowledge that when I want to do something that represents quantity, the right output is not a number followed by a percent sign. It is, in fact, a visual dial or a bar chart or something to that effect. And so I think, you know, there's going to be this continued evolution. And I'm curious, I've seen a few articles flash across around MCP extending into the GUI space that I think, if that happens, will give model authors a chance to actually train conventions around how to generate visual components that will really bring the actual UX of an AI app a whole lot closer to what we expect when we go to an arbitrary web page and have an interactive UI directly there in the browser.
Yeah, this is very exciting because I've been looking at MCP UI and what Block is doing in this space as well. But really, we're doing the same thing as part of the project we're building, which is we're calling a lot of AI agents, and these AI agents are rendering UI components based on the result that you're getting. So this is going to be a document that we want to show and we want to preview. This is a link, this is an image, but this is a URL to an image. We don't want you to expand. So I think that visual representation hasn't yet been standardized. Maybe MCP UI is one potential way to implement it, but we're far away from a standard RFC that every browser or agentic or AI application implements, every phone implements. If you look at the reason the web succeeded, it was open standards. And everybody adopting those standards, my web page renders in your browser, and it doesn't matter what browser you're using. We're way away from that when it comes to AI applications, to the way these AI agents are interacting, and none of them are able to display those visual elements. And there's also the security risk, right? You don't want everybody to render UI components that make it look like your bank, for example, and you can log into that bank. So I think watch this space. There's going to be a lot of evolution, especially in the UX and the experience. And a lot of what we've built in the last 60 years of compute has still been based on the same kind of interfaces developed for the early mainframes. You know, the teletype, if you look at the terminal that you have in Unix systems, they're all evolutions of the same thing. Even your keyboard. Right, when your keyboard says they're QWERTY, that has been an evolution of, you know, typing machines and typewriters. Like, all of these things are evolving on previous systems, and I'm eager to see something developed from scratch in this space. And I think AI is going to enable a lot of those innovations to come in and say, what if the user interface wasn't a keyboard and mouse? What if we had a different way of engaging with these systems? And I think AI, especially with the progress is made in visual and voice recognition and generation, are going to give you those options in the future.
I'm going to move us along to our second topic today, which is Anthropic just announced another raise. It was their Series F raise. And this is becoming something of a trend in the industry. I think Databricks just did their Series K. These are letters of the alphabet that they did not teach in my kindergarten VC school. So we have a lot of things going on in the private markets, public markets right now, where very large, fast-growing companies are staying private for much longer than they used to, and at way higher valuations than was the case. But it is becoming increasingly the norm these days. There are a couple of things that I want to talk about, kind of where Anthropic just is in the market, right? Because it is an impressive number of valuation that they came in on. And obviously they're, you know, one of the big leaders in the space. And Mihai, I'll probably throw this question over to you to maybe start with. You know, there's almost like two ways I sometimes think about Anthropic. You know, one, I think they're kind of known amongst all the big AI players as being more focused than other people are. They're really going after the code use case, where if you look at like OpenAI or Google or some of the other ones, they're kind of doing like everything. They're kind of going after the full stack of what a model can potentially do. And so I think like one way to look at where Anthropic is in the market is it's carved out a niche for itself. That's a very lucrative niche where they've had what has been a reasonably durable advantage for, I would say, a quote unquote long time in AI years, even though it's like, you know, like dog years or something at this point. But a different way to look at it, if you look at like the commercial success of AI so far, there's really just two killer use cases: chat, code, right? Like that's where all the money is so far in the space. Like obviously a bunch of like enterprise use cases are spinning up, but like the thing that a lot of these big valuations are riding on presently is like those two things. And so I'm curious, when you look at Anthropic, do you see a focus player, or do you see there's two markets and they have the leadership position in one of them?
I think it's also a question of cost effectiveness. So right now, Anthropic, in my view, has the best bang for buck model for code. And they're, I would say, Opus 4.1 model is the best planner for AI agents. It's really, really good at this focused use case, but it's not very cost effective. So if I were to use the same model for general chat use cases, I'm sure I would get great results, but it would be 10 times more expensive. than what I can do with a smaller, cheaper model. So I think that's where you kind of see Anthropic really shine, at those more expensive, more complex use cases that you get a lot of value from, as opposed to the general chat. They're great at everything, but they're too expensive to use for everything. And I think this is where we're going to see a lot of niche players carve their market. The small, tiny model that's really, really good at one thing, does it well, but happens to be extremely cost-effective at that.
That makes sense. And maybe throwing it over to you, Gabe, you know, GPT-5 came out, and like the initial reaction to it, we're going to talk more about GPT-5 in the next segment as well, but the initial reaction to it, people are like, kind of bearish, and they were expecting more. And then, you know, they were like, oh, it didn't deliver as much. But then over time, if you've just like monitored the sentiment online, it's like turned more positive. People are like, this is a pretty good model. Like, there are aspects of it from a, like, there are people who like, at least on the MOE podcast, it has not become the default coding platform. But there are definitely people out there who have switched to GPT-5. You know, I'm curious, you know, start with Gabe, but curious on the whole crew's opinion on this is like, how durable is, do we think, Anthropic's advantage in the code space? There's been a lot of speculation on what their secret sauce is, and like nobody seems to like totally agree on that. But you know, I'm just curious how, you know, what do you think about like that market and how sticky it is and how kind of durable their position is in it?
Yeah, so I want to answer that in two rounds. One, at the meta level, how durable is the position of AI in the developing market writ large, Anthropic or not? And then where does Anthropic sit relative to the overall use of AI in the development market? So on the first topic, and maybe this is foreshadowing the next segment that we're going to cover, but it's kind of one of those once you start, you don't go back situations. Sometimes as a developer, it's really hard to get your brain plugged into how does AI fit into my workflow? Like, I've been writing code for decades. I know how to do it. I don't need something else to help me. Once you find even a small piece of your workflow that AI actually naturally slots into, it's really hard to go back. So I think AI as a whole is durable in the development space because it really does help actually remove blockers and remove friction points. As far as Anthropic's presence in the developer space specifically, I go back to my previous answer about like a model can't actually do anything. A model fundamentally has to have the patterns trained into it to be able to perform in a given system and take certain actions in a given system. And I think Anthropic is doing a great job of building models that work extremely well with the systems they are building around it. I think their durability is going to entirely be pinned on those systems that wrap the model themselves. So it's, again, back to UX. It's, Claude Code is an excellent user experience. It's found resonance with developers. There's many other similar options out there. But back to the earlier conversation about defaults, Claude Code is sitting in that default position for terminal AI assistant. They just really have managed to figure out the right sets of tools, the right prompts for those tools that work well with their models. And the whole pieces of the puzzle come together in a package that provides a fuzzy but tangible advantage. And I think they will have to stay on the ball about that ecosystem that they've built if they want to stay in position. I think the models themselves, you know, the benchmark scores, the fundamental capabilities of the models for, you know, isolated experiences is going to even out the playing field. It's going to level out. And especially if you're focusing on specific use cases that you care about, to your point, Mihai, we're going to get smaller specialized models that are way cheaper and can accomplish that specific task just as easily. However, the overall tooling and user experience is the place where I think they're going to hold their advantage.
One other angle to this is, and Kautar, I'll throw this one over to you. It'll be our token vibe coding, discussion of the week. But to your point, Gabe, about like these things needing to be wrapped in systems, you know, their Anthropic's growth, like Claude Code is obviously one of the primary ways that people consume it. But like, there's all these new AI-powered development tools like, you know, Cursor and Windsurf. But Replit is maybe another example of this, and I think has been like very successful and grown really fast on the back of vibe coding, and particularly for the sort of like prosumer sort of space, for not like the person who's like, you know, Gabe, who's been developing for decades, but, you know, the person who's getting into coding and like these new AI powered tools are actually helping to get people over the hump of, you know, the initial periods of like unproductivity and feeling like, you know, even just environment, getting your environment set up is like a major barrier for people, never mind even writing your first line of code. How big do you think the opportunity is, and just like, what have you seen in terms of, as these models and the systems that wrap around them improve in capability, like how large of an opportunity do you think it is for just expanding the market around code, period? Right? Are we heading to a place, like I've seen two kind of patterns around this. I'm just curious your take on it, which is, you know, one, some folks think that we're heading to a place where anyone's going to be able to build or at least prototype anything. And that's going to become standard practice. Like forget the kind of traditional development process, just get 80% of the way there and throw it to somebody who's a professional sort of thing. Then I see another kind of take, which is that the speed ups that you're getting there are kind of fake, and they're not as big as you think they are, because the amount of refactoring, the amount that you have to go figure out what the code's actually doing, like the security implications there, like the path to productivity for vibe coding maybe is not as straightforward as people think it is. But if it did work, obviously the TAM of what that would do to this whole market would, you know, go up way more. And so, you know, I'm just maybe starting with Kowtar, just curious like how you think about vibe coding and just like the accessibility of programming as like a major component of like what this market will look like long term.
I think this is a huge opportunity. And of course, you know, for the players that get it right, like you said, you know, there is vibe coding in a setting like where you're doing proof points and small prototyping, but there's also the serious coding that you want to get, you know, as part integrated in a real enterprise setting, in your real workflows, with safety and, you know, a lot of compliance and making sure that you get the speed ups, making sure that, you know, things are bug free. And so kind of product versus experimentation and proof of concept and research and so on. And of course, I think with Claude, they have a lot of advancements, you know, when it comes to their Claude family of models for code. So their coding LLMs has been quietly, you know, gaining traction, especially in the enterprise workflows, particularly because of its marketed as safer and more reliable for professional environments like legal, healthcare, and finance. So coding LLMs, they're a major part of their product edge, but also Anthropic's position is broader. It's also safe, enterprise-ready, and aligned AI. So I think there's also, you know, this hype that we're seeing. And I think the article that we were discussing here, you know, showed, you know, that hype where I think right now we're kind of over the, you know, the big hype and we're trying to enter the pragmatic phase. Can this make money for us? You know, if I use, you know, these code LLMs and so on, what's the ROI for my investments? Is this safe for me to use? How do I integrate it? How do I maintain this? So I think there is a lot more to unpack there. It's not just about vibe coping, but how do we do it efficiently, safely, and in a manner that's going to bring us a return on the investment here and be enterprise ready. So I think it's the space, you know, it's going to be growing. And of course, it's not just about one model, like Gabe keeps saying. It's how do you use it? How do you wrap it around? How do you, you know, maintain that there's a whole life cycle behind it? And how do you make sure that the codes that are generated, they're pragmatic, they're efficient? So it's not just about, you know, how do they integrate in the whole stack? How do they run efficiently on your hardware? You know, how do they manage all the, you know, compliance and, you know, safety? It's a much more complex thing than just, you know, generating automatically, you know, a few lines of code or even big lines of codes. So integrating that in a serious workflow, it's going to take a lot more work than just, you know, quick, you know, vibe coding. So who gets that right? Of course, it's going to be a huge, you know, opportunity. And I don't think we're going to completely replace the programmers, because programmers here, of course, you're going to get them over humps, you're going to boost their productivity. But we need also these developers that understand, you know, the output of these code LLM, understand how to integrate them, understand how to orchestrate, how to, you know, utilize that part of a big design. So maybe other skills need to be required or acquired at that level. But also, you know, platforms that allow to do these things, to test, to debug, and maybe other LLMs will do the reasoning and the debugging and so on. So it's going to be a whole workflow that needs to be done right, efficiently, and also in a cost-effective manner. And I think Anthropic is making headways in that space, especially with their safety motto and the enterprise focus. And but maybe we'll see other players.
Yeah, I think all we need to see is one failed release and developers are going to switch over. Last week, for 3 days, I switched from using Cloud Code to Codex. And the reason why is because when I was trying to use Opus 4.1 to actually go and write some test cases, he would look at my code and go, "Well, these test cases are failing. I will just remove the test cases." It's like, "No, please fix the code." It's like, "It's easier to fix the test cases." And he kept doing that again and again and again. And when I look at the incident report, I see an incident report now that says 6 days ago, for 3 days, Opus 4.1 was seeing degraded quality. Users were seeing lower intelligence or issues in tool calling with Cloud Code. So I was directly experiencing that. And immediately my reaction was, well, this isn't working. I'm going to switch to the next model or I'm going to switch to the next tool. There's a lot of choice. If your Google Chrome browser isn't working, you're going to switch to Edge. You're going to switch to Firefox. You're going to find another browser. You're not going to say, well, for 3 days, I'm not going to use the internet.
So I think that's actually a great transition to our final segment that we're going to do today. You know, we were discussing ROI and just even getting to that through the hype cycle. You go through the hype cycle and then you wind up on the plateau of productivity. And while I still definitely think we're still in hype cycle a little bit, there's also like aspects of the market that are transitioning, I think, to that real like productivity and like, how do we get value out of this? But at the same time, I look at the internet every day and I look at discussion online every day. And there's another segment of the community that is just in a totally different place. And like, there's a thing I've observed is that there's actually like a market, a real market out there for AI cynicism. And it's not, like, I don't think it's like sober analysis. It's not like, oh, this is too hyped. Like, I'm still a fan, but you know, the thing you're saying it can do, it's not quite there yet. It's much further than that, where people are kind of rooting for failure, you know, talking endlessly about bubbles, the collapse of the economy, we're destroying the planet. Like, you know, it's really kind of much further than that. And I'm curious what y'all think is motivating that. Like, a simple one is like, maybe it's just purely fear, which is, you know, a normal fear of change sort of thing. But it's beyond, I think, just like traditional technology skepticism. And to me, and I mentioned this earlier, but like, I felt like GPT-5 was kind of a flashpoint for this, where people looked at that and they were like, oh, it's so over, you know, like progress is stalling. And then, but when you look at one of the progress curves over time, you're like, seems like it's still progressing pretty normally. Like, why are people freaking out about this? There's lots of use cases that people are starting to find really valuable. And so I'm just curious how y'all read the situation and, you know, whether any of you just see there's like any plausible universe where we could wind up with something as like the fourth AI winter in this cycle, or are we just in kind of like permanent productivity from here? You know, Gabe, it looked like you were kind of winding up on
yeah,
that one.
I got a couple yeah. thoughts on this one.
Fire away.
Yeah. And I teased this in the last one, but you know, to your question of why, it really feels like it's all about an expectations game, right? So I think there are certain members of the AI community that are very fond, or perhaps they built their brand on projecting into the future. And, you know, sort of for better and worse, there are those that project into a utopian future where AI really plays the role of humans in roles that humans don't like to play. There's those that also see that exact same future and get extremely pessimistic and worried about it. And while I don't want to rule out either of those possible futures, I love a good sci-fi book as much as the next. The place we are today is around a technology phase change. And in that sense, this is, there's nothing novel about this. You know, Mihai, you said it great the other day. If for some reason you download an update to Chrome and your browser just literally segfaults when you launch it, are you going to not use the internet today? No, of course not. You're going to find a different browser. The same thing, I think, is rapidly becoming true about AI in our daily lives, even in ways we probably aren't even realizing. And I think if today, you know, all of us lost access to all AI models, we would feel that pain, each and every one of us. Like, even if we are an AI skeptic, there's probably somewhere in our lives that it has started to creep into our daily workflows. So I think from a technology phase change, no. You know, the article we read spoke to the previous AI winters. All of those had the commonality that the funding and the usage of AI was isolated in a very small number of specialized users that had been oversold on the potential capability and got disillusioned. I think we are to the point with the technology at this point that it is ubiquitous enough that generative AI is not going to go away. Now, the funding for some elements of generative AI may go away, especially the ones that are looking at those further reaching futures. And to wrap back to that further reaching future question, Brian, I think the reason we see so much appetite for this skeptical view of it is just, I think, sort of human nature in the sort of most evolutionary, basic, like competitive survival of the fittest type of perspective. I mean, I don't have an encyclopedic knowledge of sci-fi genre, but if you look back pre-internet, you didn't have a deep literature imagining a future in which humans could communicate instantly, right? I mean, yeah, that played its way in, but that doesn't start to approach and replace the humans in those narratives. AI has always occupied this place in the human psyche of what happens if, like, how much of me is reproducible in a machine. We've been writing books about that and telling stories about that, time immortal, right? And so that, I think, is really where the skepticism keys in on, is the dystopian view of what happens if we actually achieve that. But from a technology perspective, I think it's here to stay. And I think a steady investment is not going to go away anytime soon.
Yeah, I totally agree with Gabe. And I think we're not really heading for a full-blown AI winter. But the industry here is experiencing kind of a slowdown, but more of a reality check. I think the debate over GPT-5 highlights, you know, kind of a critical gap that we have between the optimistic promises, like the bulls, as mentioned in the article, and the practical concerns. And I think it's kind of a period of a bit of a slowdown, which is an opportunity also for the industry to focus on real-world problems and sustainable business models. Because historically, if we look at past AI ventures, they've occurred when, you know, overhyped promises failed to materialize. And, you know, that kind of led to this sharp drop in funding, interest. As, like, for example, the first AI winter, it was caused by failures to achieve human-level intelligence. And the second was, you know, due to limitations of expert systems. And so the lesson here is that these unrealistic expectations are the biggest threat to AI progress. But I think what we see here is, you know, I think tons of investment has already been made. And so today's AI is embedded in billion-dollar products, you know, ChatGPT, Claude, Copilot, and others. Past AI winters really did not have any real market traction. There is also huge infrastructure that was built, like GPUs, cloud, data scales, you know, which mean innovation doesn't really vanish, you know, it really compounds here. And of course, you know, some of the similarity I see with the past AI winters, you know, there is, you know, the hype versus reality. So investors expect AGI like leaps, but I think the progress is more like incremental, especially what we see with GPT-5. It is slower versus GPT-4, but it is, for me, it's more incremental. It's going to take time. And, you know, I think also there is a bit of a maybe over-reliance on these benchmarks. You know, just like expert systems failed when taken out of the lab, current LLMs right now, they're showing some brittleness in the wild. So that's going to, you know, there will be some friction, you know, when you take these things and really apply them in real to solve real problems. So certain parts will fail, certain parts will work. You know, there's going to be a lot of refinement in the reality check here. But today's ecosystem, I think, has a sustained revenue stream. And that financial base didn't exist in past winters. So like Gabe said, it is here to stay. And we just have to, you know, I think, keep making the progress. And hopefully, you know, of course, there will be ups and downs, like any big technology shifts. And we've experienced this also with the Industrial Revolution, you know, with the, you know, the print also revolution, when storytellers were replaced by print. Many people were not happy, but you see what the print, the publishing did, you know, to the industry and to our lives. So it's just, you know, like we all see here, it's just a shift and a reality check more for AI, not really a winter.
I'll give a different take on this, which is, I think the progress has actually been tremendous, but invisible. Because we've seen a shift in the cost of these models where we have intelligence too cheap to meter. We're seeing all these models get integrated more and more and more to the point where they become transparent. You just happen to be using some kind of an AI as part of your application. It behaves better, but it's so fast and so cheap and so effective at what it does that you don't see it. You don't interface with it like you would with ChatGPT. It's just part of the application workflow. And I'm also seeing a shift in the focus from building models which give you that raw performance to models like even with GPT-5, where they have that router, they route you to different models. I don't think they've quite perfected that yet, but the direction is very positive. I think the price changes, especially if you look at Nano, which is, I don't know, 5 cents for 1 million token or something that's insignificant, is amazing. And I think if we continue in this direction, we're going to see AI embedded more and more and more into application workflows and into real-world systems than just a consumer thing where you type into the box and you get an answer from the AI.
I think that's a great place to end on. Mihai, Kautar, Gabe, thank you for joining us this week. For the listeners out there, like, subscribe if you're a fan of the pod, and we will see you back next time on Mixture of Experts.